Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited to have with me Dr. John Miller today to tell us all about his book titled The Philosophy of Tattoos, published by the British Library in 2021. This is a very cool book. This goes all over time and space and looks sort of practically at what tattooing is today. What does it mean culturally? What does it mean economically? And helps us connect that with the historical cultures, plural, of tattoos, and questions about what tattoos mean and why do we kind of keep coming back to them in so many times and places. So, John, I'm so pleased to welcome you to the podcast to tell us all about your book.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Before we dive into all things tattoo, though, could you maybe introduce yourself a bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. So I am a senior lecturer in 19th century literature at the University of Sheffield, and I don't normally write or think about tattoos. So I've come to think of tattooing as like my academic side hustle. So I've been interested in tattoos since I was a kid. I don't remember a time when I wasn't interested in tattoos. There's no real reason for me to be interested in tattoos. Like growing up, I didn't know any tattooed people. And back then, you didn't see tattooed people in the media. If you walked down the street, you wouldn't see tattooed people in the way that you do today. So I don't really know why I've been fascinated by tattooing my whole life. But I have been. And so I came to write this book sort of by accident, really, I think. So when I was doing my PhD research, which was on exotic animals in Victorian adventure fiction, I was reading a bunch of travel literature and literature about empire from the late 19th, early 20th century. And I'd occasionally find references to tattoos or sometimes some short stories about tattoos. And that led me to start collecting tattoo stories at the same time as I was collecting tattoos myself. And I did a book for British Library Publishing as part of their Tales of the Weird series called Tales of the Tattooed, which was my kind of first real foray into tattoo academia. And then on the back of that, they invited me to write a short book about the philosophy of tattoos, which I said yes to mainly out of self-indulgence, really, because part of the book is sort of my tattoo autobiography, which I can't imagine anybody else would publish if I didn't kind of crowbar it in to a book about the philosophy of tattoos or some other tattoo academic subject. So that's kind of how I got into it, really.
That's quite an interesting story, and I think perhaps not as self-indulgent as you make it out to be.
I think it is. It feels self-indulgent.
Well, it doesn't read purely as self-indulgent, so there is that. Partially, I think, because you've structured the book very thematically, which I found really interesting, because, of course, choosing themes is always really hard. So can you tell us what are the themes you chose and how did you end up with these ones?
Well, some of them, I think, are kind of inevitable or necessary rather than inevitable. And certainly they were part of the remit that was given to me, because this book is part of a series, the philosophy series with British Library Publishing. Most of the other ones are about drinks. There's a philosophy of gin, philosophy of wine, some other food stuff, philosophy of curry. So this, it's kind of a weird fit with the series. But because the series requires a broad sweep around the topic, so the first chapters, origins and histories, seem to be really necessary for the book to be something that you could call the philosophy of tattoos. So thinking about anthropology of tattooing, some elements of archaeology of tattooing, and then the most ridiculously generalized sweep about tattoo cultures, particularly in relation to colonialism, because that's a lot of what I'm interested about, and decolonization. So that's the kind of first two, origins and histories, the first two chapters. The third chapter, which is revivals, follows on from that historical focus. So when a lot of tattoo traditions in various parts of the world are repressed through colonization in the 18th and 19th centuries, 20th and 21st century see a lot of these tattoo traditions, mainly indigenous tattoo traditions, are really having a renaissance. And that is often something that's associated with tattooing culture in general in the 21st century as this flowering or renaissance of something that had kind of didn't appear to be so much in the foreground in the 19th and 20th centuries. That how true that is open to debate. So that's the three chapters. The fourth and fifth chapters, I think, are more controversial, or maybe a little bit less central to the history of tattooing. So the fourth chapter is on deviance, and there is clearly an association of tattooing with deviance, but it's quite historically recent and geographically specific. So the idea that tattooing is a deviant practice is an entirely weird thing to say about something that's happened more or less everywhere, more or less forever. So, I mean, archaeology tells us that you know, tattooing goes back thousands and thousands of years. There's evidence of tattooing, you know, really in all cultures in the world. So if you get this idea that tattooing is the mark of outlaws or rebels or weirdos or perverts, all of this stuff you get in the late 20th century, it's kind of a bizarre thing to think about. So part of that chapter is to think about that idea. And I feel kind of ambivalent about it myself, because on the one hand, it's not historically accurate or ethically helpful to think of tattooing as deviant. But when I was first getting into tattoos, like a long time ago, even before I was tattooed myself, I was really drawn to that kind of secrecy and edginess of tattooing. So I've got like a kind of contradictory relationship to deviance. I think historically it's compromised as a lens on tattooing, but also I'm kind of really drawn to it in kind of 21st century Europe. And the last chapter is on magic, which is something I wanted to explore because it's central to the history and anthropology of tattooing. But in 21st century Britain, it seems something that you wouldn't associate with tattooing anymore. So it's a part of tattooing that's fallen away from the kind of consumerist, materialist world that we live in today. And I'm drawn to those older histories and interested in holding on to ideas that might seem to fit at best awkwardly with the dominant worldviews of kind of 21st century Britain and Europe and America. And so all through that, there were various moments when I do bits of my tattoo autobiography as well, which is something that the form demands. So in books about tattoos, you get what I call the tattoo confession. So some people, because there's more and more academic books about tattoos now, so you get like often in a preface, somebody say, well, I haven't got any tattoos, but, you know, I once thought about it, or somebody, I've got one small tattoo. But there's a kind of, in the tattoo world, there's a kind of scorn towards people who engage with the topic without having any tattoos. There are a number of tattoo artists, not many of them, who are tattoo artists but haven't got any tattoos. And in the kind of online world of tattoo culture, that's kind of like a weird thing to do. Why would you be a tattoo artist if you haven't got any tattoos? Or why would you not get tattoos if you are interested enough in tattoos to become a tattoo artist? And in books about tattoos, there's this thing about, you know, you need to dip your toe in the water rather than just observing it from the beach. And that's a paraphrase of a quotation by Samuel Stewart, who wrote this amazing book about tattoos from the late 20th century. So that's part of it as well, the story of me getting a tattoo bodysuit over the last 23 years.
That is quite a story and quite a summary of the many topics of the book, which I think listeners will understand kind of why there's so much to get into just from that exploration of the themes. And many of the points you've raised, I'm probably going to ask you about in a bit more detail as we go through, now that we have a bit of a foundation of kind of what the scope of the book covers. And the first thing I want to ask about is this really interesting quote earlier on in the book, which is you say that, quote, a tattoo might mean nothing, but getting and being tattooed means something. And that, in some senses, seems to follow on from that discussion of having a tattoo and writing about it, or being a tattoo artist and not having tattoos. So can you tell us a bit about kind of what you mean with this argument?
Yeah, well, some tattoos mean something. A lot of tattoos mean a lot to a lot of people. And there are some particular traditions of tattooing that have a really strong sense of significance. So a tattoo, a particular tattoo, might record a genealogy or convey some particular message about the wearer and their allegiances within a particular culture. What I meant by this quotation, I was referring particularly to how tattooing has emerged into prominence in the kind of consumerist metropolitan world of late capital. Let's call it that for the sake of argument. So there's an argument in pre-existing tattoo literature that tattoos have become undercoded. So rather than being intensely meaningful as they might be in some cultures, or very specifically meaningful, it kind of mean nothing at all. So people often ask people, you know, what does your tattoo mean? And I mean, if you read a lot of interviews with the heavily tattooed people, you often get the answer, doesn't mean anything. So it's just a picture on my skin that needn't have any direct symbolic significance. So often when that question's asked, what does your tattoo mean? It's an invitation to think allegorically about tattoos. So this tattoo might be about, you know, a friend who died, or a lover, or whatever. So there's some explicit reference from the tattoo to some other thing in the world. Now, I've had people say that about my tattoos. So my back piece, the tattoo on my back, is of two deer. And when I was in the tattoo studio getting that planned out, the guy who ran the tattoo studio, Lal Hardy, very famous tattooist and commentator on tattooing, said, I bet that's your wife and your child, which I hadn't thought of before. You know, it was nothing to do with that. But there's a sense that tattoos invite an act of interpretation, that it must refer to something else. But that's become increasingly unstable, and this is part of the way in which different tattoo cultures have circulated around the world and connected to, you know, quite controversial topic of cultural appropriation. So you see somebody you know, in Sheffield, where I am today, you know, walking down the street with kind of Pacific tattooing, you know, what does that mean to them? Well, it doesn't mean what it would mean to somebody in the Pacific context. So that is kind of what we mean by tattoos being undercoded. They don't mean as much as people might expect them to mean, or what they might mean actually in other cultures. And certainly the more I got tattooed, the less the individual tattoos meant anything particular to me. It was much simpler in that I just like getting tattooed. I went to London to get tattooed, so it was a day out. And, you know, I enjoyed the growing flow of the patterns on my skin, so it was more about pleasure than it was about any significant part of my life. So it didn't really communicate anything beyond my skin. So that's what I mean by it kind of might mean nothing. But when you're in there and there's a needle buzzing in and out of your skin like 1,000 times a second or whatever it is, know, it does feel like a meaningful experience. It feels ritualistic. And when you go and lie down on the couch, you know, the hair on your skin is shaved so the tattoo can be applied. So there is a kind of ritualistic element to it. Of course, it's really painful, depending on which bit of your body you get tattooed, more or less painful. So it feels like, you know, it, but the experience means something even if the art doesn't. It feels, I don't know, what does it feel like? Kind of therapeutic for me. I've always conceived of it in that way. And there's a kind of physiological explanation for that. When you're in pain, your body releases endorphins, which kind of makes you feel good, releases adrenaline as well. So I always found that getting tattooed has been a positive thing for my mental health, as much as I do it just because I like it. So that is also part of that kind of meaningfulness of it, even that if the tattoo itself doesn't communicate any great significant meaning. People often talk about a tattoo being an investment in themselves somehow. It's something you do for yourself. It's something I feel has a connection to well-being and fulfillment in some deep and strange way.
Mm. A lot of the things in that answer kind of, as you said, sort of point to the well-being, point to the self and the individualness of it. But also there's some kind of clear implications around connections with other people, that other people might, for example, read meaning into it, or that we have, it means different things in different cultures, which of course culture only means something if you can talk about it with someone else or communicate it with it about someone else. It doesn't exist in isolation. And this is something that I really appreciated you sort of picked up in the book. It wasn't just thinking about what does this mean to an individual, but also what does this mean in a group, in a society, in a culture, and of course the interplay between those two. It's certainly not a binary. And I really was fascinated by the idea of what we can open up, what thinking, what philosophical ideas or ways forward can we open up when we actually do this explicitly, when we think about tattoos in terms of social experiences, in terms of, even in the book you talk about, ecological experiences. Can you tell us about this?
I could try. So there's a lot in that question. So firstly, we might think of tattoos as a way to express or to create your own unique sense of being. That's certainly part of the myth of tattooing. I'm not saying it's not true, but that's certainly part of what it says on the tin. You know, this is part of the reason people get tattooing, just so it can be our own unique individuals. Nobody's got the same tattoos that I've got. So that is a powerful way in which you control your body image, how your body exists in the world. But as you say, you can't control how other people read the text that you create on your body. So one example about this that was prevalent in the 1990s, I think it's faded away a bit now, there was this trend of people getting swastika tattoos as a reclamation of an ancient Hindu symbol that had nothing to do with the Nazis. So that was, you'd see, you know, people with extensive tattooing that would contain swastikas, and they would say, you know, I'm not a Nazi. This tattoo is about this, you know, longer historical meaning of it. But that, of course, is a really problematic thing to do, because even if that's what's in this person's head when they got this tattoo, this is a kind of celebration or reclamation of a kind of pre-Nazi image of it. It's not what people see. So that is a way in which you can understand that tension between that tension between the intentionality behind the tattoo and the way that it's read or conceived in the social world. So people will have preconceptions about tattooing in general, that any tattoo might say something about somebody, and there's a really conservative resistance to tattoos that's still in the British media today. Melanie Phillips, if you're listening, of course you will be, will have thoughts about this. You know, Melanie Phillips, the Daily Mail writer, who always, you know, said recently that tattoos made her feel sick, physically sick. It's kind of very interesting. Theodore Dalrymple, who wrote a review of my book, was really opposed to the idea of tattooing, that it infringes some kind of integrity of the human that maybe that has theological implications somewhere down the line. I don't know. So those are all like really complicated issues about it. Of course, in some cultures, it's a very particular way of identifying with others. Think about subcultures, for example, about gang cultures, like particular tattoos are ways in which you express these forms of community or forms of allegiance. Think about punks or something as well, how it marks off particular subcultures. You know, biker culture as well is another that gets a mention. But of course, all kinds of people with no relationship to any kind of gang or affiliation have always got tattooed. When this whole idea that it is confined to particular social groups has never been true, even though it's never been more untrue than now, if I've got this sentence right. I mean, even kind of in 1950, not recognised as a high point in Western tattoo culture, all kinds of people were still getting tattooed. It wasn't just a kind of thing that was widely recognised in the media, that you do get throughout history various stories about how tattooing comes to prominence. And Matt Lodder, the tattoo art historian, is the person to look into if you want to hear more about that. So that's kind of social elements of it. The ecological angle about it is something that really it intrigues me. And this is something that I don't see much literature in tattooing theory and scholarship. And maybe there's reasons for that. Some of the subcultures I've just mentioned would appear to be like antithetical to the idea of ecological thinking. I mean, one of the guys who tattooed me when my first tattoos was a real kind of petrol head, a real biker guy. And, you know, when he found out I'm a bit of an eco warrior, which I am, he was like, you know, relentlessly taking the piss out of me for it. And he said, you know, we'd love to eat the last tiger that was alive. So there is that, you know, there is that. But at the same time, various tattoo cultures have really close relationships with ecological ideas. And I got into this partly through the work of Lars Krutak, who's an anthropologist, works particularly in tattooing. His work on tattooing in Borneo, for example, looks at ways in which indigenous cosmologies create intersections between tattooing and the natural world, particular animals, for example. And if you go into any old school tattoo studio, you get all around the world, you get what's called, all around the walls, you get what's called flash. So I mean, a lot of tattoo studios now are custom tattoos, so you don't see that on the walls. And I guess the internet and social media has meant that you don't need to see the images that the tattoos can do actually in the shop. But you can still see this in some places, all of these pictures around the walls. You know, back in the old days, you go in, you pick out a picture, you get a stencil, and that's like your kind of menu to choose from. But if you look at that, it's very biodiverse. There's always flowers and animals. So that there's definitely always some representational connection between the human body and the natural world that happens through tattooing. And often it doesn't appear to be meaningful. So like a swallow, that's like an old traditional jail tattoo. I think about the idea of kind of freedom when you're incarcerated. But nonetheless, you're putting an image of another creature on your body. So I'm really interested in this idea that in my tattoo adventure over the last nearly quarter of a century, I've kind of redefined my humanity. Have I? I don't know, because most of my tattoos are of creatures or of kind of foliage and trees and stuff like that. So my own process in getting tattooed has been to make my human form less human, or at least to acknowledge in my epidermis all kinds of relationships for the world beyond the human, or that's in dialogue with the human. And actually, I got into this, my first thoughts about this were from an academic called Betty Marenko, who did a really interesting piece in a tattoo magazine based on an exhibition, and this must be going back to the 1990s. And she's got zebra stripes tattooed on her back, and it was an exhibition with accompanying text that explored, I guess, the idea of wildness and tattooing. So that was what an early influence on me, beginning to think about tattooing signifying relationships beyond the human.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you for taking us through sort of that thinking and again how it integrates the kind of ideas and practicalities of all of this, which is one of the fascinating parts about tattoos, that the physicality and the practicality cannot be divorced from kind of thinking about it, or at least I don't think it can, and your book certainly entwines them pretty strongly. So I'd like to ask about another aspect of the book that you briefly mentioned when talking about the themes, of course, is the idea of tattoo renaissances. And I really loved that you don't just say tattoo renaissance, singular, that there are multiple, and multiple different kinds as well. So I was wondering if you could maybe help us understand the different kinds and introduce us to one or two.
Yeah, so the term tattoo renaissance has done the rounds quite a lot as tattoo literature has grown, both in terms of formal academic scholarship and in media pieces, of which, you know, there's millions and millions of these now. So it's a term, I think, I might be wrong, that dates from 1980 or 1981, and it's attributed to Arnold Rubin, and it refers specifically to an American context, I believe. So this is in the wake of kind of 1960s counterculture. You begin in the 70s and into the 80s to see more and more tattoo shops in metropolitan centres in the States, which encouraged him to think of the idea that, you know, from that point onwards, tattooing was being reborn after having gone into hibernation through the 20th century. So, I mean, I think this probably isn't really true. I mean, so, and again, I would acknowledge the work of Matt Lodder. I think he's done more work than anyone to kind of critique these ideas. I mean, there was an earlier tattoo renaissance, I think in the kind of 1890s through to about 1920. At least there were various newspaper reports you can see, like, from like 1895 or something. Like, look at all these people getting tattooed. Isn't this like weird and bizarre? Tattooing is having a renaissance. So the kind of Western tattoo renaissance of the 1980s had kind of already happened nearly 100 years ago. And the idea that it's suddenly emerging, having not been around, of course, is not true either. I mean, so there were certainly people getting tattooed even when it wasn't particularly visible in popular media. Though, of course, we can say now, you know, just let's stick to the UK to make things simpler. There are so many tattoo shops and there's so much online content about tattooing. When I was first trying to get tattooed in 2001, you know, by which point the so-called tattoo renaissance had already taken hold in many places. I was living in rural Cornwall at the time and I was looking through the yellow pages for tattoo shops. You know, there was hardly any at all, and the ones that there were, you know, weren't very good. But now there is so much work that's just so amazing, so artistically accomplished, so distinctive, that draws on existing traditions but redefines them in incredible ways. So much amazing large-scale work that you didn't see before. So certainly, you know, tattooing is having a heyday at the moment. So that's your kind of Euro-American tradition of a tattoo renaissance. One of the things that's really interesting, which I researched a bit for the book, is about indigenous cultures and tattoo renaissances. or tattoo revitalization. So the story here, and again, this is a ridiculous generalization, but you get European empires through their empires in the kind of 18th or 19th century, through the Christianization of cultures, attack tattooing as a sign of savagery. So all the tropes of colonial racism were involved in this as well. So in some places, tattooing is really pushed to the margins to the extent that you hardly see it at all. In others, it's a different case altogether. But through decolonization in various places, then you get the rediscovery, or not necessarily the rediscovery, but a revitalization or greater prominence or greater visibility of tattoo traditions that hadn't been seen so much during the periods of colonization due to repression, marginalization, etc. So the two I looked at for the book, one is from the Arctic and subarctic, which is the Inuit Tattoo Revitalization Project. So, really fascinating story there. So all the tattooists in that culture were women. And I think by the time that the project began, there were very few examples of that style of indigenous tattooing about. And there was just a few elders and some documentary evidence that was still left. So the people working on that project were trying to piece together a tradition from not particularly adequate evidence. So it's a really interesting case study of how now people are rediscovering those traditions, that part of their kind of history, and revitalizing Inuit tattooing. The other one I looked into, and there were more elsewhere as well, was the Mark of the Four Waves movement in the Philippines, which is a kind of diaspora movement. I think that was founded in Los Angeles, where there's a big diaspora people from the Philippines, and that again is about recovering a tradition that had faded into the background. So Mark of the Four Waves refers to the four waves of kind of immigration into the Philippines, I believe. I'm not an expert on this at all, so go to the source and read a lot of the really interesting work about Filipino tattooing. So those are two examples of indigenous forms of tattooing that have really flourished over the last 15 or 20 years ago, drawing on historical records, bringing people together, forging a kind of revitalized sense of community and identity through traditions of tattooing that hadn't been so visible in the decades up to that.
So those two examples in particular give some very clear sort of positives of tattoos becoming more mainstream. And even the example before that of you being able to find a tattoo shop in rural Cornwall today versus 20 years ago suggests another. But in the book, you also talk about this mainstreamness of tattoos being a double-edged sword. So what's the other side of the sword?
Well, there's a really beautiful article from an anonymous tattoo artist in The Guardian a few years ago. I'm going to not get this quotation quite right, but the analogy was that tattooing is like some mysterious creature from the bottom of the sea, and as soon as you dredge it up, it dies. So that sense that what was alluring about tattooing, and again, this would be in a Euro-American context, it is destroyed by the relentless visibility of it. You know, you turn on your TV, it's full of tattooed people. We walk down the street, it's full of tattooed people. The tattooed people are everywhere. And all of these tattoo TV shows like Miami Ink and Tattoo Fixers, Just Tattoo of Us, all of these that are, you know, not particularly serious engagements with the history and experience of getting tattooed, just make it seem kind of superficial, I suppose. So it's part of the consumerist ethos of neoliberal culture. And you can definitely trace connections between that Western tattoo renaissance and the birth of neoliberalism. They kind of coincide historically. If we think about Rubin coining the term in 1980, which, you know, is when we've got Thatcher and Reagan, and often thought of as the time when neoliberalism takes hold. So all of this deprives tattooing of what, for me, when I was first interested in it, was this kind of spellbinding mystique. And I remember, like, growing up in Deal in Kent, there was one tattoo studio there, and it was run by a man called Painless Jeff. I don't suppose that was his given name. And it was in a basement underneath a shop where you could buy trophies. Like, if your team won the cup or whatever, you get the cup engraved there. But if you went to the basement, you'd meet Painless Jeff. And I never went there. I was only a kid, but I remember, like, walking past there. I always wanted to peek down the stairs. And I was really drawn to that sense of the tattoo studio as a heterotopia, in Foucault's term, like an other place, a place that's kind of removed from the mainstream world, a place where you really had to, I don't know, go through some portal into another world. I mean, none of this is particularly true anymore. I mean, maybe it was never true anyway, but I mean, I'm kind of drawn to the allure of the subcultural, the bohemian, the other world of tattooing. I definitely think that it's not just me, that there's an attachment to those ideas that still lingers in tattoo culture. Even when, you know, tattooists, you know, you can make a lot of money doing it, you can be a celebrity doing it, you know, that makes the industry good to go into. But I still think there is somehow a sense of loss in that way in which that the rarity factor has gone. So, you know, when I was first interested in tattooing in the 1980s, if you saw somebody, you know, walking down the street with extensive tattooing, it was like, wow, this is amazing. Oh my God, you know, what kind of, like, courage you'd have to do that. Who would even do that? I mean, what kind of amazing, odd, weird person would you have to be to do that? And that was, like, really gendered, I think, as well. So if you saw, like, a heavily tattooed woman in the 1980s, I mean, that would be an extraordinary thing. And one of the things about the tattoo renaissance, so-called, is that the percentage of men versus women getting tattooed has apparently shifted, so it's much more equal than it was. So that sense of the allure of difference is why I think it's a double-edged sword. I mean, I think there's still that sense of a lot of people are drawn to the possibility of difference in a world of homogeneity, of kind of globalization, of kind of ontological flatness, where everything is the same everywhere you go. You know, you walk down a high street anywhere, it's equally grim and as abandoned as the next high street you go down. That tattooing might be some underground world where you can escape the dreary blandness of consumer culture. You know, I want that back, but I can't have it back because, like, tattooing is so thoroughly commodified. I blame David Beckham, by the way.
I'm sure he'll be very, want to know exactly what you blame him for and be very eager to respond to any letters you may write him.
Well, I think Melanie Phillips blamed David Beckham. I don't blame him at all. I think, you know, he was coming quite late to it already at that point.
Yeah. Well, this idea of the mainstream, the subculture, the allure of difference does come up in the chapter about deviance that you've sort of explained to us already, some of your kind of ambivalence about it. And I thought in particular that the part of that chapter that really grabbed me was the sort of philosophical questions, I suppose, that arose when you started thinking about face tattoos and especially people's reactions to face tattoos. So I'm wondering if we can maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So I've not got any face tattoos and I'm not going to get any because I've not got the personality for it, I don't think. Even today, I think it's quite confrontational, or it can be, or at least it would get more remarks because it's difficult to conceal. So most of the time, all my tattoos are covered up. Of course, you could cover up a face tattoo with some artfully positioned hair. So I'm not at the stage, I've not got any hair left to artfully position anymore, unfortunately. So there's that sense about it being uncoverable, if that's a word, is part of that. So it's there for everyone to see all the time, you know, unless you wear a balaclava, which itself would be a kind of outrageous gesture in kind of mainstream life. Of course, this is culturally specific again. Like in New Zealand, there's a different range of significances around face tattooing. But, you know, in the UK, I think it definitely takes a certain force of character to do that. In the literature around it, there's a particular association between trauma and face tattooing. Some psychoanalytic studies or psychological studies about that, I think, are quite interesting. Though I think there's a tendency or the temptation to overly generalize about that, to kind of pathologize face tattooing, that if you've got a face tattooing, you must be some kind of... you must have experienced some kind of trauma, which may or may not be true. I mean, I don't want to pronounce about anybody's history based on that, but certainly that is part of the force of the face tattoo as well, that kind of assumption that it's such an outrageous gesture that there must be some radical antipathy to society that's behind it. And the reason for that is because when you get a face tattoo, that seems to overwrite the fundamental nature of human being, because the face is how we conceive of our relationship with the divine, if we do that at all. And certainly reading back in the history of commentary about tattooing, particularly the history of anti-tattoo sentiment, there's that sense that the integrity of the body is to do with, you know, how God made us. And if we violate that, then that is even a satanic gesture. And if you do that to your face, even people get their eyeballs tattooed now, eyes, the windows to the soul, as John Donne and Abba both remarked. So that sense that it offends like a philosophically deeply entrenched conceptions of the human place in the universe. I think that's all in there somehow. And also, I mean, there's a lot of people who haven't got tattoos who just think it's their business to moan about people who have got tattoos. And that's a kind of an old truism in the tattoo world. And that is particularly focused a lot on face tattoos as well. And all these like old school assumptions about associations between, you know, tattooing and criminality gather particular force around the topic of face tattooing. So I think if anybody, you know, when you get a face tattoo, I mean, you take all of that on, I think. I mean, that's all part of it, because even if that's nothing to do with you know, how you want to express yourself, your motivations for getting a face tattoo, you can't stop everybody else from thinking that. So I definitely think that still retains the force that any kind of heavy tattooing would have had 20, 25 years ago. I think that still holds to the face tattoo, certainly in the UK today. And that fits, you know, economically, the idea of the job stopper, that tattooing stops you getting certain kind of jobs. Well, I don't think it does anymore, but I think a face tattoo might. Is it possible to imagine a prime minister with a face tattoo in the UK? Interesting question. I don't know. Probably not, I would say, at the moment, because I think that, I mean, the prejudice and the opposition to that would be so entrenched that wouldn't happen. Now, I think there was a presidential candidate in the Czech Republic a few years ago who had a tattooed face. But I don't know any other examples of that, certainly in Europe anyway.
I'm trying to imagine now Boris Johnson with a face tattoo.
Yeah, well, let's imagine that. So what would we choose for him? I don't know. I mean, maybe it will happen. Have strange things happen? Possibly not. Well, so, yes. I mean, now I can never unthink that image now of Boris Johnson's tattooed face. Now I wish you hadn't said that.
Well, you're the one who wrote the book, so...
Well, now I blame myself. Yeah.
Well, there is that. Moving from the ridiculous, swiftly onwards from the ridiculous... there's obviously a lot of questions in the current world of tattoo literature and tattoo practice. But certainly one of the questions, at least that I'm aware of as an observer of this, to some extent, is a question that is happening in a lot of places, which is the idea of decolonization in our higher education, in all sorts of places. And this is something that I appreciated you brought up in the book. How can tattoos be decolonized?
Yeah, it's a big question, and It's an important question. So I did an interview with Radio New Zealand a few days ago, where it's a really like important topic. So you shouldn't just steal other people's culture, should you? When tattoos or other cultural artifacts have particular meanings and particular cultures, then it's really important to respect that. I mean, there was a story that broke a few days ago in Yorkshire, where I am, about a kind of vintage store, through some weird quirk of fate, had in a bundle of like old, basically junk clothes that came from the States, found this really beautiful jacket that was a late 19th century Canadian First Nations, I think, jacket, which they, you know, very respectfully sent back to the original owners of that artifact. I think tattooing is part of that. I mean, there are, you know, all kinds of people who get all kinds of tattoos for all kinds of reasons. And you know, there was a time, I think it's faded into the background a little bit now, where tribal tattooing was a thing in like Europe, in America. It tends to be called black work tattooing now, and that was associated with a movement called the Modern Primitives, which I think again came out of California in the 80s or 90s, though how far that was actually a coherent movement has been subject to debate as well. And this was about kind of reclaiming some deep and more meaningful sense of human being in the wake of kind of consumerism and commodity culture through indigenous body marking practices. But these were not indigenous body marking practices that the people who were using them had any real historical relationship to. So they were just kind of appropriating them from other cultures. And the mark of the four waves, the Filipino tattoo renaissance, are very explicit about that. You know, don't get these tattoos if they're not part of your heritage. And so that, I mean, I've never got like a Maori tattoo or anything like that. I mean, I wouldn't be comfortable doing that. So I think, I mean, in terms of how you decolonize that, I think you need to know the significance of the images that you're getting tattooed, know your history, do your research. You know, many tattoo artists would be in a position to help you with that. So that's one aspect about it. Don't get your tattoos unthinkingly, which is good advice. In any case, I would suggest have some sense of the cultural weight of particular images and how they've got a history that you don't necessarily own or have any relationship with. So I think that's important. But that said, there's always also been cultural exchange between tattoo traditions. I've been going back a long way. So tattoo traditions, of course, exist locally in particular communities, but evolve over long periods of time, often through contact between different communities. You can, I mean, different versions of Pacific tattooing, for example. There are relationships between those distinct traditions, and those relationships between Japanese tattooing and kind of Euro-American tattooing through various forms of kind of trade and cultural exchange going back a long time. So it becomes really difficult, actually, to, in some cases, not in all cases, to distinguish between kind of long-standing evolution of artistic processes through cultural exchange and kind of blunt cultural appropriation. So I mean, I don't think it's necessarily straightforward to kind of come up with an easy set of instructions about how you would do that, except to say, you know, read about it, learn about it. And of course, I mean, the problem with tattooing is if you make a mistake and get a tattoo that, you know, is inappropriate, you know, there it is. It's quite a long-term mistake. I've never had anything lasered off and I wouldn't fancy it. Apparently it hurts even worse than getting tattooed. So that is kind of, the stakes are quite high. Whereas, you know, I don't know if other forms of cultural appropriation in terms of like fashion or dress, for example, you sometimes hear stories about that. You know, they're clearly less permanent than getting a tattoo from a culture that doesn't belong to you. So, that is my somewhat rambling answer. But the thing I would want to insist upon is that you need to respect other cultures that have been subject to colonization and their right to have we might say, intellectual property over their images, or just to kind of have ownership of things that are specific to their culture and have specific meanings in that, which are then lost when they're transferred to another context.
Quite sensible advice, really. Especially the idea of think about a tattoo before you put it, before you get it done, if nothing else, for the high stakes. But the idea of kind of knowing what's happening, knowing the history, again, going back to the idea of tattoos being more mainstream, this information is more available than it has been before, which would hopefully help with that.
Yeah, I mean, there's loads of great books that now about tattoo history as well. So you can read quite a lot about it and they're all beautifully illustrated, so you can get a really strong sense of what where images come from. Mm. And there's a question about what is a version of it and what is the image itself. You know, so there are, you know, that makes it even more complicated, I suppose.
Well, thank you for giving us some ways into thinking about that even further, which I think is always a useful thing for a book to do. But before we let you go, is there anything about your current work or future work, whether or not it's tattoo related, that you'd like our listeners to be aware of?
Well, I could give a plug to my book, The Heart of the Forest, Why Woods Matter, which is out with British Library Publishing, which has got no references to tattooing in it at all. It's a book about trees, which is what I more usually do. So that came out in 2022. And I've not got any tattoo writing on the go at the moment, but it's something I might go back to. I'm quite tempted by the idea of writing a literary history of tattooing, or I'd quite be interested in doing some more research about the moment when tattooing becomes more mainstreaming, maybe in the 1980s in the UK. I'm drawn to that cusp between it being supposedly more marginal, becoming supposedly more mainstream. So maybe in the future I will return to it. The trouble is with academics, they don't give us any time to do anything. But I better not say any more about that, had I?
Fair enough. Well, while you are off doing all the things that you must as an academic, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, again titled The Philosophy of Tattoos, published by the British Library in 2021. John, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you. You're most welcome. My pleasure.